So, and I'm sure we're going to be in for a real special evening. I'd like to introduce Ted H. from Los Angeles.
My name's Ted Harbach, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm alive and sober tonight by the very special grace of a loving God and the loving program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thank God that I'm an alcoholic. If you're a newcomer, that'll make you want to puke. First time I heard someone get up at the podium and say, "I'm a grateful alcoholic," I said, "Swell." And I came back 2 years later. And they told me to come back. I don't know why. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me to come up here and speak. This is always a great privilege and a pleasure for me. And I get to reacquaint myself with old friends and make a whole lot of new friends. And as a result of a magic deal called Alcoholics Anonymous, why, I have friends all over the United States and Canada. And when I got here, I didn't have a single friend left. In fact, if I'd had one more friend, one more dime, I'd have died. And I want to thank Bill for picking me up at the airport. And I'd like to thank the committee for the lovely gift they left in my room. And there's been some really terrific speakers here so far. Clint last night, some of you missed him. Why, I'd get his tape. Clint's a real special guy. And Mel, Al-Anon speaker, I don't know, kind of makes me realize that maybe my plan for the future is correct. You see, I'm going to come back in my next reincarnation as an Al-Anon. She talked about control. Can you imagine the ideal program where you can drink and work the steps? And be in control. I don't mean control of drinking. I can't imagine that one statement, the only couple of statements that I take exception to in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is one that, where we try to control and enjoy. That's a dichotomy. Nothing that you can control is enjoyable. Unless it's just the control itself. Marcy, I love Marcy. I've shared the podium with her. I don't like her standing at the podium and reading my list of character defects, however. But Marcy always talks about the blessing. And every time I hear that, why, I think about my little daughter. My daughter's been sober for 18 years. And it's no big deal. She's only 18. She thinks it's a big deal. But I was able to bless her. Because when she was born, why, I made a little prayer, and that was that, God, I know she's not my child, she's yours. And you've given her to me to just take care of and watch over and do the very best I can for however long that's to be. And please, just let me love her. And I know she's going to climb, and I know she's going to fall, but I pray that you won't let her climb too high or fall too hard. And I've been able to let her go and live her life just for her. And she's my very, very best friend. It's because of you, because you gave me the gift. Tomorrow you're going to hear Sister B. She's heard me talk so many times she left. She said she was feeling poorly, so I sentenced her to 85 Our Fathers and 102 Hail Marys. She should be in good shape tomorrow. Keith, I've known Keith since he came into the program. Hopeless. Absolutely hopeless. He stayed sober so long we've all lost money on him. He reminded me while I was talking today about ancestors and alcoholism. I can trace one ancestor back to the Civil War, and he was the only general. He was in Northern. He's the only general that was killed in the Civil War. He was leading a charge with a drawn saber and caught a mini ball in the face. If that isn't an alcoholic, I don't know what the hell is. I mean, can you imagine? I've heard of go for it, but that's ridiculous. Well, this is a summer fest, and I want to tell you that this is what life is all about. This is the deal. See, this isn't a scrimmage, and this isn't practice. This is a Super Bowl, see? The Super Bowl of life, and there's no timeouts, and there's no substitutions, and the clock is always running. And that's kind of hard for alcoholics to get used to, because alcoholics spend most of their time getting ready. So I hear these fools from the podium that say, you know, I hear them around those. They don't do that up around here, but down where I come from, they all talk about doing step 1, 2, and 3 every day. No kidding. What they're really saying is they're getting ready to start to commence to begin. They haven't done nothing. Every once in a while, I hear one of them say, well, I've got to start all over with step 1. Sorry, you got to go get drunk or loaded, because that's how you do that one. I was born an alcoholic. Unlike Keith, I happen to know that. The reason I know is because the first word my mother said was, my God, did you see how much he drank? I was only about 5 minutes old. And they'd already put me in the obstreperous ward. Now, that's a ward for antisocial babies that cannot communicate in a reasonable fashion with their peer group. I was born in an absolute towering rage. My grandfather said he thought that was funny until he saw the outgrowth of it all. So when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, why, I heard people talking about feelings and talking about hurting, and I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. All I knew was rage, see, not anger, you know. I had a meeting for a long time at Long Beach Memorial Hospital, and they started a little thing called assertiveness training. Are you kidding? I used to go right from firm to combative. Don't know anything about assertive at all. I didn't really start my drinking career professionally until I was about 16. And, of course, I'd had a lot of introductory prompting because I grew up in a family of heavy drinkers. And my mom was an alcoholic. And my dad was a binge drinker. And they're incredible because they're so unpredictable. You just never know when that's going to happen. And he never understood me. He says, oh, you're not an alcoholic. He said, for God's sake, why can't you be like me? Why can't you just take it or leave it? I said, I'm half like you. I'll take it. I said, if you don't think I'm an alcoholic, why the hell do you lock up the liquor cabinet every time I come around? He said, well, if I don't, it all turns to water. I'm kind of envious about these kids who get started so early these days. I was retarded, I guess. These ones that get started around 7 or 8. Boy, I had to wait till I was 16 before I got set free. And I don't really remember what happened. I just sat down to a little party to help one of my friends celebrate his 16th birthday and just have a few intimate martinis with a couple of intimate friends. When I got up from the table, 23 years had gone by. And I don't remember a lot of what happened, so most of my story is hearsay. I was a blackout drinker, and a blackout drinker has a lot of trouble kind of putting it back together. I don't know if you've ever experienced blackouts. more sophisticated ones call it memory lapse. You know. Getting so many sophisticated definitions these days. You hear the definition of the problem of that captain of the Valdez that ran that oil tanker ground up in Alaska. I understand they're selling franchises now. They had four more recently. They decided that his whole problem was he was an episodic drinker who became occupationally dysfunctional. I wish they could have been articulate when they described me. You know, the headline should have said, "Local resident interrogated by minions of the law regarding certain behavioral patterns." Instead of village drunk in tank again. I finally put one blackout back together. I'd gotten home and come to on a Sunday, and I remembered I'd been out that Saturday night, and I'd been in the most fabulous bar. And all I could remember was that there was azure blue wallpaper on the back bar, and they had gold toilets. And I had the most marvelous time as I reconstructed it in my mind, what was left of it. And it turned out that I realized they had fabulous music, and the baby dolls were just gorgeous. And the bartender poured triples without being asked. So the next couple of weeks while I went out on this little safari trying to locate this bar where I'd had such a fabulous time, and finally I found myself in this bar, and there's this azure blue wallpaper behind the back bar, you know. And of course, the girls weren't very good looking because it was only about 9 in the evening. They don't really get gorgeous until 2 a.m. And so to make sure I was in the proper location, I turned to the bartender and I said, "Listen, I was in here a couple of weeks ago and I really had a fabulous time. And just to make sure, though, is this a restaurant that has gold toilets?" And about that time, he yelled across the restaurant to the band leader and he says, "Hey, George, I think we found the drunk that peed in your tuba." A little fringe benefit there. But see, something happened to me when I drank alcohol that I've never heard described by a social drinker. In fact, I don't think social drinkers ought to be allowed to drink. I mean, you talk about an insanity. You ever been over to their house? They all have bars, and they have bottles in them, and they're full. I used to have a secretary that was a social drinker, and we'd go out to lunch every once in a while, and she'd get this glassy look in her eye like she's about to have a spiritual awakening. And she'd say, "You know, I feel like a glass of wine." And I'd say, "Why? What happened that made you feel that way?" You know, "I always felt like one." And then she'd order this thing, and then she'd sit there for God's sake and drink half of it. It would make me crazy. I could just see it evaporating. I'd say, "For God's sake, why don't you drink the rest of it?" She said, "Oh, my dear, no. If I did, I might get dizzy." I said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll order an imperial quart. You just pour that mother down. You go right through dizzy to fun. You know, you won't even know you've been in dizzy." God, and then just at the moment it starts to do what it's designed to do, they quit. That's another part of chapter 3 that I just absolutely sends me into hysterics, where it says in there, "Medical science has not yet found a way to turn drinkers of our type into normal drinkers." I suspect they're talking about social drinkers, you know. And can't you just imagine the day when medical science finally announces a pill that'll make me a social drinker? Then I'm going to think, though, if one pill will make me social, I wonder if it comes in a six-pack. But what happened to me, I've never heard described by a social drink, because when I drank that alcohol, it ripped all the terror out of me. Just ripped all the terror out of me. See, I had to sacrifice my life to keep you from finding out that inside here was a terrified, absolutely terrified little child. And I damn near made it. So if you don't identify with my story is a story of where you can and will go if you have to go out again. My story is a story of a terminal alcoholic that went just as far as you can possibly go on the runaway freight train of alcoholism. Then I went one step further, like I always do with everything. So when I drank alcohol, some amazing things happened. See, all my life prior to that time, I felt like an alien on a foreign planet and nobody had given me the brochure. And that just explains it all. When I drank that alcohol, I could move across a line into a secret place called the Land of Someday Isle. Someday I'll get it together. Someday I'll have that relationship. See? But over there, I could do the one thing I'd wanted to do all my life. I could just step out easy because all the terror was ripped out of me. And I could go anywhere and I could be anything and I could do anything without any fear. And I could be a part of and I could measure up to and I could be as good as. The only problem I had over there in that land of Someday Isle was to figure out who you wanted me to be so that I'd be part of the group and what you wanted me to say so I'd fit in and what you wanted me to do so you wouldn't throw me away. And so I spent all those years over there in that chameleon-like, people-pleasing euphoria of the alcoholic. See, rationalizing and lying to myself, justifying my position to live up to your expectations, real or imagined. And that's the life of an alcoholic. And in between those times when you kind of come back across the line again, that's not the invisible line. I stepped over that when I was born. That's just the line between being able to step out easy and the line between having to live in reality with all of the pain. See, they talk about alcoholics being sensitive and then everybody laughs. But Silver Hill Foundation many years ago did an in-depth survey, and they found out that alcoholics are indeed far more sensitive than any other human being. I think there's a reason for that, and Marcy kind of touches on it when she talks about the earth plane. See, I think alcoholics are very old souls, and that's why we care. You know, new souls just kind of quasi-modo through life, and you know, nothing seems to bother them. They just bumble along and they get, you know, a wife and 2.3 cars and 4.1 kids and mow their damn lawn. I'm for wall-to-wall dirt. I love that. Jesus. I think the ideal front lawn is green concrete. Let the neighbor hose it off if it gets dusty, you know. But alcoholics care too much. And when we care, it creates pain. And then we're taught to generate pain all on our own. See, because our parents and their parents before them found out the secret that to really rule a person and can control them, you do it through guilt, shame, and fear. And so, I don't know about you, but early on after I was born, being obstreperous and noisy, they tried to calm me down. And so my mother would come in and sing a lullaby, you know, rock-a-bye baby from the treetop. And it goes on, when the bough breaks, down will come baby, you know, and that kind of terrifies you a little bit there. Then the old man comes in and he tells you that if you don't shut up, sit down, shut up and listen, you know, like a newcomer. Why, the boogeyman under the bed's gonna get you. You know, and then he goes out and shuts the light off. And then you tune up a little bit more, and then mom comes back in, and she gives you the first, serenity prayer of your existence. Now I lay me down to sleep. If I should die before I wake. You know, I've just been born. I've fallen out of my fern. I got a damn boogeyman living under the bed, and they're talking to me about dying, and the damn lights are off. And then the old man comes back in and lays one of those parables on you. There's nothing to fear but fear itself. You know. And then as you grow a little older, why, they lay a lot more of that crap on you, you know. Children are to be seen and not heard. Now play a solo on the piano. You know. And don't trust anybody. Don't tell anybody what's really going on inside. They might think ill of you. It might not sound good to the neighbors. Don't get to know yourself. Don't feel good about yourself, because that's prideful. Don't touch yourself, especially there. And then they give you the answer to life. Look before you leap, and he who hesitates is lost. And you hear all this crap. Keep your nose to the grindstone, keep your shoulder to the wheel, keep your eye on the ball, and you try and get any work done in that position. Look before you leap and don't hesitate, and there's nothing to be afraid of, and you're crazy is what you are. And then they tell you, no, there'll never be any problem as long as you tell us the truth. And then you try a little test missile just one time. You what? You're grounded for 40 years. So you learn to live in an insular world where you are in control, where nothing can happen. Where were you last night? Nowhere. Who were you out with? Nobody. What did you do? Nothing. Why were you so damn late? I don't remember. You stick with that and you're home free. You know. And then you come to Alcoholics Anonymous and they tell you it's an honest program. Are you serious? Lying works. You think I was going to tell that judge down in San Diego the truth? When he looked down, you know, and they look so imperial, peer at you. So, Mr. Harbach, I would like you to explain to the members of this jury and the people of this court how you could possibly be going 80 miles an hour on the Coronado Ferry. Can you imagine my telling the truth? If I told the truth, they'd be piping sunlight to me today. Oh, sure, Your Honor, tell me to be honest. Truth of the matter is, I'm an alcoholic and I was just drunk out of my mind. I'm a blackout drinker, and my blood alcohol content was right up there around smooth. You know, 0.06, Your Honor. I feel if you're going to drive, drink. Face traffic with confidence. Fact of the matter is, I don't even remember how I got on the damn ferry. We were going duck hunting in Barrett Lake, and you can't get there on the ferry. But I'm a former race car driver, and all of a sudden, why, a couple of things started happening. There's a green light flashing and a horn going off, and we're racing. Man, I snapped out of that blackout, and I only know three things to do under a circumstance like that. You just ram the accelerator all the way through the firewall, slide your left foot off the clutch, and hang on. Halfway across Coronado Island, while the red light came on, I asked the gentleman if we'd won. He said, "You bet. Here, press hard. There's three copies. Your prize." Besides that, Your Honor, I'm just a scofflaw. I don't give a damn about people, places, or things, especially yours. I have only one speed in my car, fast. Don't think I've had any brakes either. How do you like them apples? You know? Every bit of that had been the truth. You think I was going to say anything like that? You're out of your mind. I said, "Your Honor, in answer to your request, I'd like to submit an evidence as document stipulated to the fact that the character defect in my car that was the proximate cause of this disastrous event has been corrected to the complete satisfaction of the Department of Motor Vehicles, the local San Diego Police Department, and the Sheriff's Department. And that said proximate cause was indeed a defective accelerator." Then I can assure the court and members of this jury that it'll never happen again. Yes, case to sniff. Well, lying works. Getting honest is difficult, you know. Behind that alcohol, I could do all those things. I became a race car driver behind a Ford's birth certificate when I was 16 years old. Stuffed one through the crash wall when I was 17 and was told I'd never walk again as long as I lived. At the age of 19, when I walked back in my doctor's office with a broken thumb, he said, "How'd you break that?" I said, "I fell down." He said, "How'd you fall down?" I said, "In a downhill race on skis at 80 miles an hour," and he fainted. At 18, I was a charter member of the Mount Baldy Ski Patrol, the only... probably the most dangerous mountain in the world, as far as I'm concerned. It used to kill 6 people a year as regular as clockwork, social drinkers, you know. They'd have half a glass of wine, they'd fly off the backside of the mountain, you know. Free fall into Victorville, you know. All you'd hear them say as they went by the barricade was, "Oops." That's dumb. You'd never hear an alcoholic say that. He missed a barricade, he'd just look back over his shoulder and say, "Downhill race, go for it." All right. I was the only member of the ski patrol who wasn't thrown off for drinking. They thought I came that way. I found out early on the difference between a hero and a coward. It's booze. 1948, I helped do the first article for Life magazine on scuba diving, and I don't know how many of you have been under the ocean, but I want to tell you, that's terrifying. They got animals under there. Got one called a spider crab, looks worse than my former mother-in-law. We found out how to dive and be heroic. All you got to do is put a dish of pure grain alcohol right in front of the intake manifold of the compressor and bubble the air through it, and fill the tanks with 50% alcohol vapor. Man, you can stand right on the deck of the ship and get euphoria of the deep. You get down there about 100 feet and you see the gills on the fish moving. You think you've got gills. Give them a little breath here. Yeah, great big halibut. Try and stuff that mouthpiece in him. Every once in a while, I'd see one of those divers just kind of drift off. So long, pal. More for me to drink. Because we didn't give a damn. So every guy I drank with the exception of one, is dead. Those are the kind of guys I drank with. Only one of them left. He's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, there was one other one, and he was a kind of a dribbler, though. We used to let him drive. But all the others are dead. Behind that alcohol, I learned how to fly planes upside down, 6 feet off the deck over Santa Monica. Boy, you've never seen a surfer wipe out like that, man. Just twist that, torque that plane over right over where they're surfing, man. Just wipe out about 40 of them. Behind the alcohol, at the age of 24, I went into the building business. I was one of the youngest subdividers in Southern California. I was building over 200 houses a year. And already I was in the grip of the terminal progressive disease of alcoholism, and I didn't know that. My partner would look at me and he'd say, "My God, how can you drink those martinis at lunch? If I had half a martini, I'd just go to sleep." I said, "Well, a feller like you just shouldn't drink." See, but booze was the fuel that fired the boiler with me. Everything works opposite to me, for me. Everything. I can have 10 cups of coffee and fall asleep behind the wheel just as easy as that. I used to get tired waking up behind the wheel 80 miles an hour. Surprising. Oh. Narrow highway. Drank up $2 million construction companies. Just seemed like a good idea at the time. And I didn't know that if I was in the terminal progressive disease of alcoholism. And it wouldn't have mattered if I had known. Because my big book tells me that knowledge is no defense against drinking. None. And I had to run out my string. And I guess the best way to describe the way I drank is just to kind of describe a typical day of drinking in the life of Big Ted. And usually that'd start at lunchtime. And I'd developed a nervous tic where I'd be ready to sign something and my pen would fly across the room. And that's the flyaways. And the minute that pen fly across the room, I'd know that it was time for lunch. Because if I didn't go to for lunch now, I'd fly across the room, 8 million pieces, ain't anybody going to put me back together. Sometimes lunch was early, 6. Sometimes it was way late in the day, 5 after 12. You know, but when the pen went, I went, you know, and you walk across the street into that padded sewer that you're used to going into, and but everybody's got to be cool. You got to have them all trained, you know, and in case you're there on a real important business deal. Bartender says, what would you like? And you look at your watch, an alcoholic watch, has only one hand on it. Say, well, I got time for one martini. And just as he starts to turn, you give him the real order. Make it a double, put it in an old-fashioned glass, leave out the onion, no ice. That way you know you're going to have about 3/8 of an inch of freeboard so you won't drown this brain surgeon next to you. His scalpel keeps flying across the operating theater. He's got a big one coming up. Finally brings you the drink there, and through an ingenious system of geometric levers, well, you get it in your face without drowning him, and then you say your first 3 prayers of the day. God, I hope it stays down. God, I hope it works. God, I wish he'd get back. And that kind of heals over, and that ice cube with 8 million corners kind of starts to melt, and you notice that it's not raining inside your suit anymore. And then you notice that that hand that couldn't hold a pen a moment before is just as steady as a rock. And then you look at that perfectly synchronized reflection of yourself in the back bar mirror. Ah, Clint Eastwood, you devil. Then you look down at this brain surgeon and you say, what kind of day are you having, crap head? And all of a sudden, your world comes all together and it's round and it's smooth and all the sharp edges and the rough corners fall off and it's warm and it's comfortable and you slip in over to that land, the Someday Isle, where you're fearless, where nothing can bother you, insulated from reality. And you can do the one thing you wanted to do all your life. Just step out easy. That's all I ever wanted to do. Now you got to get back over to the office and work like crazy because the cocktail hour's coming. Yeah, you got to get back over there in that padded sewer one more time where the big deals and the baby dolls are and drink until the traffic clears. 10. Bartender can only make a 15-minute drink, so you drink from 5 o'clock until 10 o'clock. Now you got 20 drinks under your belt, and you're back over there in that land of Someday Isle. All your merging genes are together, you know. Now you only got one problem. Hope they haven't stolen my car again. Beverly Hills Police Department said if I reported my car stolen one more time, they were going to impound me. Finally find your car, and you got to drive home real careful by now, because by now you're driving an alcoholic car. You've seen them. They're long and thin. Mine got that way from parking in narrow garages at high speeds. And then you have all these other character defects that you need to get them cleaned up if you're a newcomer, because the police have been notified that the drivers of these cars are suspect. Like the license plate hanging by one old bolt and last year's registration there, and exhaust pipes dragging on the ground. You need to wire that up with a coat hanger there. Mine, I love those ones with the red cellophane for taillights. You know? Now they got red backup lights. You don't know if those mothers are coming or going. And mine had these little whiskey bumps all over it, especially on top. I found out that was from trying to open it when the keys were locked inside. But it had one special character defect. The left headlight looked straight down like this. That was neat, because that way it was easier to see the double line when it got foggy. Every night about 10, when the traffic cleared. And I loved sobriety tests. And I think they've taken a lot of the competition out of it now. Better law enforcement through chemistry, but in those days we had the physical sobriety test. You know. What a joke. I mean, can you imagine? We had a reciprocity agreement on the ski patrol where we could work on any mountain that we wanted to in California. So when the snow would get bad down south, why, we usually pick Mammoth, because it was the best. And from Los Angeles to Mammoth is a 2/5 drive, any way you cut it. And along the way, while I learned to drink and drive professionally, some of your friends are getting arrested for having alcoholic beverages in the driver's compartment, why, that's tacky, so you might pass this on to them. I remember one time we were going to Mammoth and got about as far as Mulholland, which is about 2 minutes away we drove, and turned to this friend of mine and I said, do you have anything to drink? Mine was up on top of the car in my ski poles because I'd invented the drinking man's ski pole. Because I believed in looking cool, those Boda bags and bottles that got tacky. But each ski pole will hold a pint. And you just take the top off and let's take that run. You know, it's cool. Never freezes. Not the kind I drank. 157 proof Ron Rico purple. Oh, are you kidding? Just don't smoke. So I turned to this friend and I said, do you have a drink? I had forgotten to bring my drinking and driving and passenger bottle. And he said, yeah. He handed me his hose off on the dashboard. And I said, what the hell's that? I wanted a drink, not an enema. He said, well, dummy, he said, just put that little pipe in your mouth and pull the windshield washer knob. He kept a six-pack of Cutty Sark up forward of the radiator there where it stayed nice and cool. And then we'd stop in Mojave and refuel and take on a little gas, too, on the way. Drive into Mammoth there. We used to race the cops in those days. It was bad form to radio ahead. If you could get across a county line, you were set up for the next team, you know. And you haven't lived till you've been through a Red Rock Canyon at 118 miles an hour with a couple of flaming maniacs at the wheel. And one time we hit a deer on the way up, and we were driving a big Cadillac with a full race engine in it. And God, did that deer... We really messed that deer up. He was just a little feller, too. Tore the whole front end out of the car and doubled up the hood and smashed the right side of the windshield. I was passed out in the back seat, or I'd have gotten killed. He ended up right next to me. I just put my arm around him and asked him if he wanted a drink. I said, what kind of furry broad you picked up? Got into Mammoth. You're so damn drunk, you know, you can't stand up. And you fall out of the car onto the ice there, and some Al-Anon's been lurking in a snowbank. Al-Anon's lurk. A lot. And she sees you, and you're it, man. She's going to rescue, fix, and repair you. And she clasps you to her warm bosoms and takes you into the warming-up hut to get you tuned up for the day on a half a gallon of Grenache Rosé. But usually the first thing she says was, there's a deer in the back seat. Have you ever noticed how dumb the things are they say? I mean, there are some dumb things going on in life, you know. Like, why do people drink non-alcoholic beer? Oh, I don't know. I just don't like getting drunk, and I just want a big gut. Why does anybody drink decaffeinated coffee? Get a little eye drop with colored crud in it, you know, and jeez, I just don't understand it at all. Non-alcoholic cold duck wine. It's almost as bad as being a social drinker. There's a deer in the car. Yeah, right, he was tired of walking. We just... Thirsty, too. Like scotch. And in about 9 o'clock in the morning, some fool has nailed a number to your chest and you find yourself at the top of this damn mountain. You're entered in a downhill race. With that kind of handicap, now I got to tell you, if you can clear those gates and not wipe out all of the timers and spectators, a physical sobriety test is no big deal. Now, I loved them, so on the way home, this cop stops me, and cops are just as bad as doctors. They're just the masters of understatement. And he says, you know, your headlight is out of focus. You're kidding, it's shining on his foot. But you make a mistake and you say, what light?
And with that statement, a lot of gaseous breath blows on him. But he's not quite sure yet. They're a little dense.
And he said, "Why, that light up there?" And you go, "Oh." Registering surprise and amazement. Then he looks at you with this incredulous look of disbelief and he says, "And you've been drinking, haven't you?" Like you're going to tell him the truth.
Well, they've already given him the answer so that he can pass the police test. Two beers.
"Oh, sure, officer. I just polished off a six-pack of Cutty Sark and just keeping the score to beer company until we get home. Top fell off of it." Explosive beer. Home brew. Then he gets this triumphant look of the crusader on his face, and he says in this large Wagnerian voice, "I'm going to give you a sobriety test."
God, I was so excited. I opened the door so damn hard that when he stopped me the next night, he was talking this funny little falsetto voice. Thought I was a different cop. And can you imagine after entering a downhill race with that kind of handicap going to Mammoth, and this fool wants me to stand on one foot, put my head back, and touch a nose the size of mine? Are you kidding?
Next night that he stopped me, he was incensed. "You haven't gotten that..."
"You haven't gotten that light fixed."
"So what light?" "That was a different cop. A little vein in his forehead was jumping in and out."
"You know damn well what light."
"Anyway, you got to stop on the way home and buy a bottle in case guests stop by." Then you get home and you throw the top of that bottle away and pour yourself a nice little conservative 16-ounce highball there. Then settle down for your favorite TV show, you know, Test Pattern. Turn that music on that's filled with hope, you know, my favorite artist, Ray Charles, Born to Lose. It's crying time. And the Al-Anon song, "Please Release Me." <laughs> 6 o'clock in the morning when the alarm goes off and you're out of bed like a tiger ready to do it all over again. I get out of bed in the morning, I got a blood alcohol content high enough to go to jail 18 times for drunk driving, and I'm wondering if I ought to have a little straightener outer. And at noontime it starts over again. And I don't know that if I don't go to lunch when that pen flies out of my hand that I may go into an alcoholic withdrawal. And I don't know in that withdrawal that I might go into a seizure. And I don't know in that seizure that I might shatter my spine in 6 places like one of my best friends. And I don't know that in that seizure I might very well die of the terminal progressive disease of alcoholism. All I know is I got to go to lunch. And it wouldn't have mattered if I had known, because knowledge is no defense. All I know is I got to play out my string. And it's got a long time before it's going to run out, before the string is finally going to run out. I only got 2 drunk driving arrests because I was a technical driver and never drove without drinking. And the only 2 drunk driving arrests I ever got were both just bad breaks. And I remember one, the first one happened when I ran away from home to get married when I was about 30. And some friends of mine threw a great big stag party for me down on one of those yachts in Newport, and they were drinking my favorite thing that day, booze. I don't understand people who stand up at these podiums and say, "Well, I didn't like the smell of it, and I didn't like the taste of it." I loved everything about it. I loved the smell of those bars the next morning at 6 a.m., you know. That's the mark of a true professional. And I become very conservative in my driving when I overstep the mark, and I still don't know why the police stopped me, because I developed a technique for driving in those days because I was busy. And I was building all these damn houses, and I had a telephone in the car. I was driving a little single-seater Thunderbird in those days. It was permanently converted. You know, some Al-Anon that I was dating said that it was stuffy, so I just unclipped the roof and converted it. In fact, we were going 92 miles an hour, and
Man, the top goes down fast. But when you're busy and you're drunk and, you know, you got a lot of things happening when you're driving. You know, you smoke a cigarette, you got to get rid of the ashes, and you got to watch your rearview mirror for the police, you got to listen to the phone, and turn on the radio, and you got to keep one eye covered so you know which lane is yours. And you're busy. So I developed this technique of driving where I just put the phone under my shoulder like this and just put my head on the door jamb. And cigarette ashes would kind of drool away here, and rearview mirror is right there. You know, and the little hose is hanging out of the other side of your mouth in case you need to dial in a drink. Dial a drink. You know, and the only thing you have to be consistently concerned with is to remember that your lane is the one on the bottom. So I was driving along the Santa Ana Freeway on the way home, very conservative. I was clear over on the right-hand side of the freeway and minding my own business in the dirt. Yeah, going about 5 miles an hour. And when the police officer stopped me, I looked up at him and I said, "Why'd you stop me?" He's real humorous. He said, "Well, we don't allow people to make movies on the freeway." And we thought you were filming a rerun of Wagon Train. And then the son of a bitch opened the door. And I fell out. And that's the first time that I ever recall saying, "Oops." Same thing happened 7 years later. I was at a party in Glendale. I remembered it vividly. I was in between blackouts. And I left the party at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I had to drive home very, very fast because I had to get home before I passed out. Because I passed out a lot, and I got these horrible accidents, and it's very embarrassing. The engine comes through the firewall, and your door falls off the car, and your date gets misplaced, and you don't remember where she is. And so I drove. So I left this party at 2 o'clock in the morning. I've been driving 100 miles an hour for about an hour. And when the policeman stopped me, I figured I should be fairly close to home. It was only 7 miles. So when the police officer stopped me, I just looked up at him. I was still busy. I said, "Look, officer, give me a little break. I'm only a couple blocks from home." He said, "Where do you live?" I said, "I don't know. You have my driver's license." He says, "Well, it says here you live in Beverly Hills." I said, "Right. Nothing gets by you." And he opened the door. And I fell out again. It didn't impress me. But I decided to find out what the real problem was. So I went to this psychiatrist. And I said, "You know, I am really nervous. I have this problem with this pen. Now, I don't know if I look like I just fell off the turnip truck or what, but he asked me the dumbest question I've ever heard in my life. He said, 'Why are you nervous?'" I said, "Listen, Huckleberry, at $65 an hour, you're going to figure that out." He said, "Well, do you drink?" I said, "Certainly, I'll have a scotch and water." He said, "No, that's not what I meant." He said, "How much do you drink?" I said, "I'm not sure. How much do you have?" And then he said, "No, that's not what I meant either." He says, "Have you drank all your life?" I said, "No, not yet." And the little vein on his head was jumping in and out. Everybody's vein on their head jumped in and out after they'd communicated with me for a short time. And he said, "Well, do you dream?" I had no problem with step two when I got here. I used to sit in those bars and think up dreams to talk to him about the next morning at $65 an hour. I wish you people would stop going to psychiatrists. Keith may not have anything to criticize him about, but I do. You people, I've determined, are the reason that they have the highest suicide rate of any professional group known. I mean, look what we do to the poor clucks. If I was a psychiatrist, I'd have a sign on the door that said, "No drinkers allowed." Or people with peppermint on their breath, either. Now, finally, after a protracted period, why, he gets honest and he says, "Well, I don't think I can help you anymore. You better go to A&A. And then he hands you a little bill, and you look at, oh, $35,000, no big deal. And you cut him a check there, and the bank calls him and tells him it's no good, and he jumps out the window. So then one night, while you come home, and you just decide, you see the animal in the entry hall mirror one more time, and you just decide, we're going to just kill you. So I went upstairs, and I dug a .45 automatic out from under the pillow. I kept it there because they were after me. You have to be paranoid to know they're after you. And I qualified expert with a .45. I hit what I aim at, and I jacked a shell into the chamber, took dead aim between my eyes, and blew an $80 mirror off the wall. Scared my tenant next door so bad, he ran right out and joined AA. 6 years later, I remember when he walked into his first meeting and I said, geez, you got to do something about those moths. He'd been in any of his wardrobe, he'd have died. 40 caliber moths and everything. Finally, well, I ran out my string and I came out of my last alcoholic blackout and I was in the intensive care unit of St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica, and they didn't have any programs for recovery in those days. Spin dry. My doctor was looking down at me and he was crying. They're almost as dramatic as police officers. And I said, why are you crying, Doc? And he said, because, damn you, you've killed yourself. I said, well, finally. You know, I've sat down across the table and talked to death 6 times in my life, and death doesn't scare me worth a damn. See, death would have been a welcome alternative to the type of life I'd become accustomed to living in the last 3 years of my drinking. Been a welcome alternative. I said, well, what killed me?
He says, booze.
God, really? I said, come on, you've been telling me that for 10 years. He says, no, you finally got it all now. He said, you got alcoholic gastritis, cirrhosis of the liver, hemorrhagic pancreatitis. You have 2 ulcers that are hemorrhaging. You're bleeding from every opening in your body. And your blood pressure is 60 over 40. If you don't know what that is, that's serene. And he said, we pushed 7 pints of your blood type, and the bank's empty, and that's the end of that tune. And besides, I said, oh, is there more? A little vein on his head was jumping in and out.
He said, yes, if you don't promise me you'll never drink again as long as you live, I won't even treat you.
I promise. Good. With or without a Salomo. I said, just get me out of here. Some puke has wet the bed I'm lying in. Ten days later, I was back out on the street, and I was drunk again. He told me I hadn't ought to do that anymore. I came off that last drunk, and I was crawling around the unfinished concrete basement of an old house, hanging on the side of a cliff in Silver Lake, crawling around the floor of that basement like an animal. And there was blood and vomit on the bed. And I reached the end of my string. I crawled up on the side of that bed and I cried out to the God of my childhood. I said, please, God, help me. And he answered me. And the only word I recall is the word remember. Somehow, I remembered a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that I'd been to. Now, I can't tell you where it was or when it was, because I used to come to your meetings regularly, about once every 2 years. I remember one meeting I went to, and talk about a program of attraction. I walked in there, and I don't know, I was in a French Foreign Legion hall somewhere, I think. You were all lined up around the side of the room, and God, you were all old. Jesus, some of you were 40. And your life was over. I mean, you had your heads in your hands, you know. Nobody paid the light bill. There's some little skinny broad standing up there at the microphone. I didn't know she was there for a long time. She was turned sideways. Finally, she turned around, and I thought, my God, that'd be like making love to a gunny sack full of antlers. I think she was pre-anorexic. Yeah, I don't remember what the hell she said, but I remember she said one thing. She said something like,
"If you want what we have."
I thought, God, honey, if you got anything, hang on to it. You need it more than I do. And then I went to another meeting. Some smarmy old-timer came up to me and said, "Sonny, all we do in Alcoholics Anonymous is we just don't drink." No kidding. Gee, that's swell. I said, you know, I had not drank for 2 whole weeks in 23 years, and life was unacceptable. Unacceptable! So if that's all you do in these dumb meetings, why, I pass. But that morning, sitting on the side of that bed, I remembered something else. See, I remembered this other meeting where an old-timer had come up to me, and he'd said this, as I recall. He said, "Ted," he said, "you're not going to make this deal." He said, "See, you're just chippying around with this deal called Alcoholics Anonymous.
That we have to fully concede total and absolute surrender to our innermost self, as far as you can go, that we're alcoholic. This is the first step in recovery." But he said, "One day, when you reach a bottom, either physically or mentally or morally or emotionally or socially or financially or spiritually, beneath which you cannot go, he said, I pray to God that you remember a magic place where you can come." He said, a place where, he said, "I absolutely promise you, you can find a way to live your life with unsolved problems without ever having to drink again as long as you live. And where you will meet people that will end up meaning more to you than the members of your very own family. Because see, when you need these people, they're going to be there. No matter how long the day or dark the night, they're going to be there. And they're going to be there just for you, and they're going to be there for only one reason. Because they care. In a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And in this magic place," he said, "I absolutely promise you that you can find a God of your very own that you can take with you wherever you go. So you need never be alone again as long as you live in a magic place called Alcoholics Anonymous." And that morning I remembered what he'd said, and I came back to a little park on Roxbury in Beverly Hills where I grew up and used to play as a kid. And that's where I found those old-timers that walked the walk of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, no one has to say much for me to know who they are. If I just watch them, see, watch how they treat themselves, watch how they treat others, watch how they treat their loved ones, watch how they treat the things that belong to them, watch how they treat animals, I'll know all I ever need to know about them. See, and I saw those guys walking through the very same things that I've been walking through in my sobriety. And I saw them doing it without taking any mind-altering chemicals or any alcohol of any kind. And they were doing the one thing I'd wanted to do all my life. They were just stepping out easy. See, and I saw them walk through the losses of loved ones. I saw them walk through losses of businesses and financial insecurity. And I saw them walking through pain and travail, and they were just stepping out easy. And somehow, in the madness of insanity that was to be mine for a long, long time, I wanted what they had. As I left that meeting that night, it was April Fool's Day, which is a good day for me. I think if you're going to have a New Year's Eve party, have one that lasts. I don't understand these people that get here on January 1 or 2. It was April Fool's Day of 1968. As I left that meeting, my God looked down on me and he removed the obsession to drink alcohol forever, never to be returned. See, that happens to some of us. It's promised in the big book. If that point has not been reached by you as yet, I pray to God that you will hurry on until you reach that point in the book where it is promised that the obsession will be removed, and it is promised. And I hope you reach that point before the test comes. You see, because the test is in the big book. And it says this, There'll come a time in the life of every alcoholic where there will be no mental defense against taking the first drink. And that's when the statement,
"Well, you just don't drink, no matter what, even if your ass falls off."
Well, I don't know who invented that, but they didn't know a hell of a lot about alcoholics. See? Because alcoholics drink, no matter what. Usually about 2 weeks before my ass would fall off, because I don't want to be embarrassed. So hurry on, lest the test come before you're ready. Those old-timers talked about sobriety like learning how to ride a bicycle. See, I could stand up here and I could give you a 1-hour dissertation on the dynamics of balance and the geometry of suspension and the physics of centrifugal force and exactly what it is that, you know, and you'd get on a bike for the first time, fall on your ass. When my little daughter came to me and said, "Daddy, will you teach me how to ride my 2-wheel bike?" And I said, "Well, I can't do that, honey." She said, "Well, how am I going to learn?" I said, "You're going to have to fall down." She said, "Oh, it's just like skiing, right?" I said, "You got it." And she's a little smarter than I am. She learned how to ride her bike on the grass. See, but I didn't have to chase after her like a lunatic father, yelling all of those dumb damn things that parents yell at kids. You remember when you rode your bicycle for the first time and how insane they got? "Don't go too fast. Don't run into anything. Don't be afraid. And remember, keep your balance." The hell is that? They're crazy. Parents. And then you crash into something and they say, "See, I told you. What you should have done was..." I love people that say "you should have." I call it... I went back and got my pilot's license back about 6 years ago because all of fear of that's been removed because it's promised in the big book. And I procrastinate a little bit. If I can just get rid of my last two character defects, I'm going to be perfect. If I can just get rid of sloth and procrastination. But I'm planning on it. So I called to reserve a plane, and I got this crap head on the phone, and, you know, she's going to make a great mom, huh?
She says, "Well, it's Friday. You should have called on Wednesday if you wanted a plane."
I said, "Fine, how do I do that?"
She says, "How do you do what?"
I said, "How do I call on Wednesday to reserve a plane? Because I would like to make the arrangements now." She said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Is this Earth?" I said, "I will repeat precisely and exactly what you just said. Did you not just say that if I wanted a plane, I should have called on Wednesday? Did you not say that?" She said, "Well, of course I said that." I said, "Fine. That's precisely and exactly what I want to do. How do I do that?" She said, "Well, what I meant..." I said, "I don't give a damn what you meant. I go on what you say. Is the manager there?" Those two people will never say you should have done anything. There are certain words in the English language that just need to be removed. "Well, I should have if I could have, and I would have if I'd known better, and if I'd been you." Such foolishness, but it works. It's guilt, shame, and fear. My little daughter came running in, and she said, "Daddy," she said, "I really feel bad." She said, "I didn't fall down all day, and I think I know how to ride my bike, and I know all about balance." But she said, "You know, I thought when I learned how to ride my bike that I'd be able to go next door and help the little girl learn how to ride hers, but I guess I can't. I guess she's just going to have to fall down too, isn't she, Daddy? Because that's the way this deal is." And one day, maybe a long, long time ago for some of you, and maybe just a short time ago for some of the others of you, while the concept of balance moved the longest distance known to mankind, from the head to the heart, from academic to experiential, and you owned it, you knew it, it was yours, it was balance. And sobriety is exactly the same way. It starts with physical sobriety because, you know, I found out this deal works a lot better if you don't drink or use. And then it moves slowly in the process through from physical to mental to moral, and you kind of look at that a little bit, to emotional to social sobriety, where you can kind of communicate with people without punching their eyeballs out through their back of their head. Financial security, maybe, where my wife, my former wife, still hasn't figured out that if she has checks, it doesn't mean she has money. We move into spiritual sobriety, and it's a process, you see. And along the way, why I found out how a magic deal called Alcoholics Anonymous really works. In the last few minutes, I'd like to just share that with you. Because there's so much confusion about the 12 steps. You know, I believe that one of the biggest mistakes that we made is taking the steps out of the book and putting them on the wall. I think we should have left the steps in the book and put the directions on the wall. And the old-timers told me that the steps were divided into three parts. They told me that the first three steps are just becoming willing to turn your will and your life over to the care of God. The next six steps are how you turn it over. And the last three steps are how you keep it turned over for the rest of your life. And that's all there is to it, and anymore. And you can do one, two, and three for the rest of your life, and you can go get anywhere. Except getting ready to commence to begin to start. I mean, it's a real move in the right direction. Now I kind of look at the steps, and Keith was talking this morning about a circle, you know. And I found out that everything in life is round, because that's just the way it is. And if you can make a relationship round, it'll be perfect. See? It'll be perfect. And when we finally get two whole human beings together, I kind of look at a relationship like a little orchestra, like the violinist and the bass player, and I can't read her music because it's written in a different clef, see? But if she gets her instrument tuned right, and I get mine tuned right, we can put them together in what we've looked for all of our lives, harmony, see? And if there's any discord or dissonance or dis-ease or discomfort, it means that part of it's out of tune, either physically or mentally or morally or emotionally or socially or financially or spiritually. Now I got to go to my sponsor and get that tuned back up. And I get it tuned back up. And we got a new orchestra leader. And he's called God. So I kind of look at the steps in a different way now. See, the way I look at the steps is in a real dynamic, exciting way. Sometimes I get the idea we're on a 5-year plan or something, you know. Heard some fool stand at the podium not too long ago. He said, "Well, I'm 7 years sober and I'm on step 7. No kidding. Moving right along. I have to promise you that I've got guys I sponsor today that are far more sober by definition in 1 to 2 years than I ever was in 10 to 12 years. Because I found out how it really worked. The way I look at it is like a giant slide on the fun zone, you know? And at the bottom of the slide, it goes into a great big circle. And it gets round and smooth, and all the rough corners and sharp edges fall off, and I can do the one thing I want to do all my life, just step out easy. See, and the way it begins to work is, and I'm working with a newcomer, and I said, well, you know, right after that part of chapter 5, it says this. It says, being convinced that A, we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives, and B, that no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, and C, that God could and would if he saw it. Not found, just saw it. The next sentence says, being convinced of this for step 3, so just let go. You let go of the slide, you know, and you've got to kind of keep your hand on the rail in case you get going too fast, you know. And you admit you're powerless over alcohol and your life's become unmanageable, because that's pretty obvious by what you've been doing out there. And then you stare with one of us and you read the first four chapters of the big book and the doctor's opinion and maybe some of the definitions in the appendices, and you realize that maybe some power greater than yourself, can you restore you to sanity? That part of the insanity that says that someday we might learn to control and enjoy our drinking, that idea is pursued to the gates of insanity or death. That's the insanity they're talking about. Not our behavior, that's a result. And then you kind of make a decision to turn your will and your life over and have to find out what that meant. And I listened to the masters. You're like Joe and Charlie from Little Rock, Arkansas, who spent 46 years between them studying the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. John Calvin from Brownwood, Texas, who's 47 years sober. And Chuck Chamberlain, God, I sure miss Chuck. And Keith and I were talking about him this morning. And remember so many things that he said, because he changed my life. And what he really meant, what Bill really meant by will and life, was thinking and actions. Now it becomes real simple, see? Real simple. Because if my thinking can become God-directed, then my actions will be God-directed, and my actions are my life. So we made a decision to turn our thinking and our actions over to the care of God, as we understood it. And now we've got to do something about it, see? And right on the next page, because Bill tells us exactly when to do it, how to do it, what's going to happen, and he gives us a bunch of promises as to what, if we just try to take these gentle steps. And I don't know anything about working a program. All I know is it says take some steps. Just take them. It's like going to get a job. The guy says, well, you got to fill out this employment application here. And the guy, oh, God, I better go get an employment application sponsor and go to some employment application discussion meetings. And you just sit down there and fill it out. See? So at the top of the next page, it says, though our decision in step three was a vital and necessary one, which means it's kind of important, it would have little lasting effect, which is kind of zero, unless followed at once. And that's now. Very complicated. Now, by a searching, fearless moral inventory. And I like the word moral, so I looked it up, and Bill means honest. Yeah, that makes it simple. Searching and fearless, honest inventory. I've heard these fools say, I did immoral inventory and then an immoral inventory. I don't want an inventory in my store. That glass is immoral. I just want to know, is it there or not? Followed at once, see? And then the inventory is real simple. It just says, make a list of everybody you're pissed off at. I got a guy through the whole damn thing and never even knew he did it. Called me and said, I'd like you to be my sponsor. I said, okay, read that sentence after chapter 5. What did you think about that? He says, I believe that 100%. I said, fine. Now get down on your knees and read that prayer in step 3 and call me back. Call me back and says, how do you feel? I said, he says, I don't know. I said, that's fine. You ready to proceed? He said, yeah. I said, he said, what do you do now? I said, I don't know. I said, why don't you take a pencil and paper and write down everybody you're pissed off at? Says that. Says resentful. Yeah. And call me back. He did that, and I said, now I'll go back on that list and write down the reason why you're angry. And he did that, and he said, call me back. He did that. He said, what do I do now? I said, I don't know. Why don't you write down everything you're afraid of? He did that, call me back. I said, now write down the reason you're afraid. He did that, call me back. He said, what do I do now? I said, I don't know. He says, why don't you write down everybody you harm sexually? Any other damn problem you have? This is when, you know, small farm animals get into the inventory. Next door neighbor's kids get back. And mom and dad sometimes get back in there, you know. Yeah, some fun, God. We all did it. We didn't do it. We thought of it. And that's just bad. Jeez, I wish I'd done that. Then he says, what do I do now? I said, I don't know. Maybe we ought to get together and talk about it. He says, all right. We did that. And closely examined it, like the book says. And discussed what character defects were pointed out. And he says, well, he says, that's a little embarrassing. You did most of that same stuff you did. I said, yeah, worse than that. He says, geez, I feel a lot better. What should I do now? I said, I don't know. I said, there's two paragraphs in the book here. One of them is step six and the other step seven. Two paragraphs. I heard people go to discussion meetings for 10 years.
Tonight we're going to discuss step six.
Oh, deliver me. Made a decision. Became willing. You imagine standing in the gates ready for a downhill race and the timer says, ready? And he starts counting. 10, 9, you feel your left leg getting real wet. Wait a minute. I got to discuss this. Two paragraphs, that's all there is. Yeah, and then asking to help you this. He went home, and I said, and then call me back. Call me. He says, God, I feel so much better. He says, listen, I've got a question for you. I said, what's that? He said, when are we going to do the inventory? And that's how easy it is. See, and right after you share that part of step five, where I come home and turn to the most magic page in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's page 75. Now I don't hear many people talk about that. And on page 75, there's 10 promises, and it's the beginning of the whole deal. Beginning of the whole deal. People say, well, how do you get a hold of the spiritual side of the program? Page 75. What do I do with fear? I'm so afraid. Page 75. What do I do about the obsession to drink alcohol or use or whatever, pull my chair up to the refrigerator or whatever your thing is? They got a program for everything today. There's 225 programs using our 12 steps of recovery. 56 of them have written permission from our general service in New York. Where I come from, in West Hollywood, they got some strange ones. Alaqueen. They even got one down there for guys that can't stay away from hookers. John Anon. There's 10 promises on page 75. You'll only find 9, but there's 10. On page 75, it says, we're preparing an arch through which we'll walk, a free person. See, I'm free today by the definition, doing what I have to do because I want to do it. That's free. On page 75, it says, if the obsession has not been removed prior to this point, we will feel it being removed now. On page 75, it says, all fears will fall away. Can you believe that? 8 years on this program, I stood at the top of a 26-story building and looked over the side and realized that all fear of heights had been removed forever, never to be returned. Never to be returned. Once again, I could return to the mountains of my childhood and climb into those gondolas and chairlifts with no fear of heights without having to take any mind-altering chemicals or any alcohol of any time. Well, this time I take my little daughter because she's 5 years old by now. She never seen her mom or dad take a drink of alcohol. Early in this program, when I first came, they gave me 3 promises. And I'm going to give them to you tonight. The first promise is this. I pray to God that you can just keep coming back and listening to the music until you can understand the words. Listening to the music of alcoholics, maybe for the first time, able to laugh at themselves. The healing magic of the laughter and the love of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous that I've seen help put back together broken and shattered human beings that no human power could have ever put back together. And the 11 programs of Al-Anon and Alateen that I've seen put back together, broken and shattered families, and broken and shattered children that no human power could have ever put back together. And the second prayer is, please pray, God, just put your hand in ours and come with us. Because see, we know the way. We've been there. And it'll be okay. But hang on real tight and don't let go. Because if you let go, we're going to lose you. And we don't want to lose anybody. Not anymore. And the third prayer, the really tough one. Please pray, God, let us love you until you can learn to love yourself. Because, see, it's all an inside job. I cannot possibly love you until I learn to love myself. And so I took my little daughter and put her in ski school because I can't teach anybody anything I'm emotionally involved with. Because the minute I try and help somebody that I'm emotionally involved with, I place expectations on them. When I place expectations on them, I'm disappointed. And then I get angry. She said, "Daddy, can I go up on the big hill with you?" And I said, "Well, we'll have to check with your ski instructor." She said, "All right." And as we started up the chairlift, we got higher and higher on the mountain and further away from the lodge, she began to get frightened, and she started to cry, and I didn't have to say those things that I hear parents yell at their children.
"Stop crying. Doesn't look good. Big girls don't cry. There's nothing to be afraid of."
I just looked at her and I said, "It's all right, honey. It's going to be all right."
"Did you always say that, Daddy?"
I said, "Well."
She said, "Well, it usually is."
They helped her off the top of the chair while she looked up at me with those tear-filled little eyes and that fear-filled little face. And she said, "Daddy, you just don't understand." She said, "You're a great big professional, and I'm just a tiny little beginner." And that's when that prayer came to me that you gave me. I looked down at her and I said, "Honey, let's pretend we're going to play a little game." I said, "Just pretend you got your hand in mine and come with me, because I've been there, and now I'm a professional. It'll be okay. But hang on real, real tight and don't let go. Because if you let go, I'm going to lose you, and I don't want to ever lose you." And that's the way we went down that mountain all the way, my little daughter and I, never falling. And when we got to the bottom, she looked up at me with the sun shining in her face and laughter in her eyes, and she said, "Daddy, can we do it again?" And without you people, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, it never could have happened. For 12 years on this deal, I was asked to be the opening night speaker at the Palm Springs Roundup, and I stood up in front of over 3,000 of you guys and you gals. In one glorious instant, as I felt that love wash over me, as I feel it tonight, all fear of people, places, and things was removed from me forever, never to be returned, directly according to the promise in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Don't ever shortchange yourself by thinking there's 12 promises in the big book. You'll know there's over 150 promises in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. My big book starts out with a promise. Says this is a story how many thousand men and women have recovered from the seemingly hopeless disease of mind and body called alcoholism. My book ends with a promise. It says, "Surely we will meet some of you as we trudge." I didn't like the word trudge, because I don't believe Bill put any word in that book that wasn't loving, kind, and gentle, and God-given. So I looked up the word trudge, because I don't like it. It sounds hard. You know what the definition of the word trudge is? Walk with purpose. And no other people in this entire world that I would rather walk with purpose than you beautiful people of Alcoholics Anonymous. And once in a while, an Al-Anon. No, I make a lot of fun of the Al-Anons. Well, they're so sick, I mean. God, their constant prayer, you know, is, "Jesus, if you'd only quit drinking." And then we quit, and their life's over. Got to run right out and marry another one of us before the nail holes heal up. On page 75, it says that though you may have had certain religious beliefs prior to this time, you will now begin to have a spiritual experience. You will sense the nearness of our Creator, and you will feel as if you are walking on the broad highway, hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. You will have brushed the face of God. You will have established a conscious contact with a power greater than yourself. All right there on page 75 and 6 more promises. My God, what a deal. What a deal. And I almost missed it. And then we go home and we ask God to help us with that deal, and then we have our list of amends. And like Keith was talking about, why you have to get busy with those guys and clean up the wreckage of your past. And said, made direct amends wherever possible. Not whenever. Whenever is a time. Wherever is a place. And read the directions on making an amend, because they're very articulate, and there are some pitfalls, because in our early blush of honesty, lots of times we confuse honesty with sharing guilt. And there are dangerous things. And honesty can be a two-edged sword.
No, it doesn't make any difference, see, because we're on this high-speed slide, and we made this inventory, and we shared, and we asked God to help us with it, and maybe we'd start making amends right away as soon as we got on the program. You know, maybe we went to the loved ones, and we wanted to tell them how sorry we were, and that we were on a new deal, and trying to clean up our lives, and the slide's going faster and faster, and now it just starts to roll into a great big curve, and it rolls into step 10, see, because it says, continue to take personal inventory, which is steps 4, 5, 6, and 7. And if you miss one, it won't work. And it's done on a daily basis because the secret to happiness is keeping current with my feelings. And when I feel the pain of discord or dissonance or dis-ease or discomfort, I know it's my thinking, not God's, and I got to write about that and I got to share it. And I got to become willing to ask Him to help me with it. And if it comes back, it doesn't come back as often. If it comes back, it doesn't have the power that it had before, and if it comes back, it doesn't last as long. But if it comes back, I've got to do it over and over until finally it's relegated to the scrap heap of serenity forever. And that's how turn it over really works. You ask somebody how to turn it over, and if they don't tell you, write it, share it, become willing to ask God to help you with it and ask Him, they don't know. Because there's a magic that happens between the pencil and the paper that will never, ever, ever happen between the mind and the mouth. And that's just the way that deal is. I had a fool call me yesterday, before yesterday, and he's going, yabba dabba dabba. I said, wait a minute. Do you have this written down? He said, well, no. Write it and call me back. Yeah, I tell you, those sponsorial conversations have just been compacted into nanoseconds. Gee, it's all different since they wrote it.
I gotta make amends to my wife, and I don't know what to write. Pick up a pencil. It knows.
Had a guy went on with that stuff for 4 months. Finally, he called me back. He read the most gorgeous letter you ever heard in your whole life. I said, how'd that happen? Big silence.
Well, I picked up a pencil.
Then it rolls into the second half of step 10. Separated by the little word and, when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, steps 8 and 9. And step 10 and 11 both admonish me on a daily basis to review my day and ask myself, where have I been selfish, self-centered, fearful, or inconsiderate? And if I have, write it down. Have I harmed anybody? And write it down and promptly make amends. Sometimes promptly is 2 weeks. And now I can go to sleep at night without that 10-faced monster going crazy up here, see, because I'm current with my feelings. And I keep a pencil and a paper by the bed, and if it starts rolling all of that stuff again, I just wake up and I write it down, and the mind says, oh, I'll screw it, he's written it, and we might as well go into nod too. And it rolls in.
Awakening, which is defined simply in the appendix of my big book as a personality change sufficient to recover from the disease of alcoholism. We tried to carry this message. What message? The message of how our personality changed to the alcoholic who still suffers. And practice these principles in all our affairs and the loop closes. What principles? The principles of continuing to take personal inventory and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it, and seeking through prayer and meditation to improve the contact, and continuing to change our personality and share this with everybody, and practice the principles in all our affairs. And when I get a resentment or a fear or a problem in any area of my work, that is the deal, and it goes around and around forever, and it's round, and it's smooth, and it's soft, and it's comfortable, and I believe it's the greatest gift that God has given to us in over 2,000 years. And there's nothing more to it than that. So I pray to God that each one of you can keep coming back and listening to the music. And hanging on to these people and letting them love you. See, until one day maybe you'll be standing in front of a mirror like happened to me. And I looked at myself and I heard myself whisper very quietly just to myself, I love you. And in that moment it moved the longest distance known to mankind, from the head to the heart, from academic to experiential. And I knew that I was sober, happy, joyous, and free, one of God's kids like He always intended it to be, before it got all broken and shattered somewhere along the way. And it was all back together, whole and smooth. And it's my job to keep it that way as much as possible. And when that happens, then you'll know. And maybe one day, if I get real lucky, why, I'll be sitting out there in the audience, and maybe one of you newcomers will be standing up here at the podium, and maybe you'll be getting a birthday cake. And maybe, if I get extra lucky, why, I'll see a tear in your eye, and I'll hear a catch in your voice, and then I'll know that you know. Because you either know in this life or you don't know, and there's nothing in between. See, I'll know that somewhere along the way you fell in love with a deal called Alcoholics Anonymous. See, somewhere along the way I'll know that you learned how to ride that bike. I'll know that somewhere along the way you brushed the face of God. I'll know that somewhere along the way you found your way and the heavens became gentle somewhere along the way. Thank you so much, and I love every one of you from the bottom of my heart.